Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Climate change may spark argument about what causes it and whether humans are to blame, but the fact is, Alaska is experiencing climate change. Here's what the US EPA said about climate change in Alaska in August of 2016. Over the past 60 years, most of the state has warmed 3 degrees Fahrenheit on average and 6 degrees in the winter. As a result, Arctic sea ice is retreating, shores are eroding, glaciers are shrinking, permafrost is thawing, and insect outbreaks and wildfires are becoming more common. In the coming decades, these effects are likely to accelerate. Alaskans are living this reality. A handful of rural communities already face imminent decisions on what to do and where to live. As climate change accelerates, many more communities will face similar challenges. Two headlines this week show that climate change is growing more urgent in our state. Governor Walker announced a new climate change committee, and a handful of young Alaskans filed a lawsuit against the state, charging it is not addressing climate change. So what are we to do? Today, we look at two initiatives aimed at assessing risk and making decisions about whether rural communities should and can stay or go. One initiative will include work from UAF, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and the Army Corps of Engineers, guided by the Denali Commission. Guest Joel Neumeyer, federal co-chair of the commission, will explain the 2009 study that they are currently funding for updating in just a minute. So, Joel, I want to welcome you to Hometown Alaska.
Howdy.
And the other project is an NSF-funded deep integration research project that includes engineers, social scientists, and affected communities assessing risk and how to think about whether to stay in a community or relocate. We have two guests talking about this new effort. Tom Ravens is a civil engineering professor and associate dean of research at UAA's College of Engineering. He's worked on coastal erosion here for several years. I'd like to welcome Tom.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And finally, from the Institute of Social and Economic Research, we have Tobias Schwerer, a senior researcher whose interests include human ecological systems, sustainability, decision science. That's my favorite one. Decision science. We need that. And climate adaptation, among many other topics. So I'd like to welcome Tobias to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So before we start talking, I want to let our listeners know you're welcome to participate in the show with your questions or comments. You can talk to us by giving us a call here at Hometown Alaska at 550-8433. Statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752. And we also welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so let's get started. Before the show, I alerted Joel that we were going to start with him from the Denali Commission, updating a climate change risk assessment that had already happened in 2009, and so much has happened that we got to take another look at it. So give us a little overview of that, and I'll ask you some questions as you tell us about it.
Certainly. Let me just begin. The commission was formed in 1998 by the late Senator Ted Stevens. He wanted an agency that could be flexible and nimble in the day. And early on, the commissioners identified that they wanted to work on projects that were based upon need and not who was the best grant writer. So need has long been a driver for the commission. So let's talk about what need with respect to permafrost degradation, flooding, and erosion means. The 2009 report that you're referencing is from the U.S. Government Accountability Office, which is an arm of Congress. And it was at the request of Senator Stevens that GAO did the study. Now, what he had done previously is he had provided funding to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do an erosion analysis of villages all across rural Alaska. And that analysis was complete in 2008 by the Corps, and then when the GAO then did their effort looking at largely the Army Corps' work. And that study identified 31 communities that were threatened by erosion, and 4 in particular that were looking at village relocation. So you have a total of 27 with some sort of at-risk infrastructure, and 4 with communities entirely at risk. Fast forward now to 2016, my 6 commissioners decided they thought that we would look at or start working on the question of village relocation and protect and place solutions. And one of the things we did is, well, we need to update the science. Science is very important in making resource allocations. And if you look at the GAO report, it's about erosion, but it's not, it does not address riverine or coastal flooding, nor does it address permafrost degradation. And so we convened a number of Alaskans who work in the field of science and talked to them about how would we go about updating it. And what we concluded through those efforts was to issue a grant to the University of Alaska Fairbanks to address permafrost degradation. And then we entered into an interagency agreement with the Army Corps to update their erosion work, as well as also looking at the coastal and riverine flooding. What we anticipate is that by March of next year, we'll have a draft report that will look at these three different factors. Now, if you're looking at one factor, erosion, that's pretty straightforward. But then when you add these other variables, flooding or permafrost degradation, mm-hmm. you then enter into the realm of complexity, because now you're laying that those different risks across all of rural Alaska and different infrastructure that's threatened. So as in a question, you know, Community A, if their airport is threatened, why is that more important than Community B's clinic or Community C's power plant? And so what we're trying to do is use science on the threats of permafrost degradation, flooding, and erosion to apply it across all communities and say, indeed, that airport is more threatened than the clinic or the power plant. And if we can do that, and we can get other agencies to embrace and support that methodology, that gives them cause to and justification to prioritize their funding for those higher risk assets.
So are you going to, I think there are, what, 230 villages in the state. Are you going to just work with those 31? Are you going to go across all 230 when you do this kind of updated science?
So my commissioners, they've assigned almost $11 million to what we call our Village Infrastructure Protection Program. Our primary focus is on those 31 villages because we know those 31 have been prioritized through science, through the erosion risks. So that's where we're doing most of our work. What we anticipate is that once we get the science back and an understanding of the risk assessment for the 200-plus villages, we may expand our vision to all the communities in Alaska. But until we actually see the results of that, we're not in a position really to say where we're going to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to make sure, Tobias and Tom, jump in anywhere. I've got a question. I think I know the answer to this. Your primary audience is really funders. Is that where this is why you're trying to give them a nice, clean prioritization? Is that and so that the dollars might follow for whatever, you know? I guess the risk assessment doesn't necessarily mean a village has to move, but it's applying the dollars in the most needed areas.
Right? Exactly. So the answer is yes, and. So, yes, we want to talk to existing funders using their existing authorities and appropriations to address the highest needs or the most at-risk infrastructure, built-in infrastructure in rural Alaska. But also, we want to send a message to Congress. We want to be able to inform Congress that we believe the 2009 GAO report needs to be updated. If you recall, the way I started this is when Senator Stevens asked GAO to do the 2009 report, it was after the Army Corps had completed their work on erosion. So what we believe will happen is that after this risk assessment is done on flooding, erosion, and permafrost degradation, the data will be there, and then it'll be an opportunity for GAO then to update the report, and then that report informs Congress about what are necessary responses on the federal level, both in terms of authority and appropriations, to address the built environment that's at risk in rural Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I mentioned that, I mean, I think the concern is, will there be federal dollars? And you're just optimistic that there will be federal dollars. And the reason I mention that is because of Irma and Harvey and, you know, the aging infrastructure across the United States that is also important. But do you feel like
Well, there's two things about the existing funding. There is funding already in place, mm-hmm. but from my observation, it doesn't always go to the highest need. That's why I think this risk assessment is very important, so we can try to influence funders to go to fund projects of the highest need, and also influence Congress to make larger level policy changes to free up dollars or to assign dollars to this risk. I look at it, the Alaska issue, as an important example for the lower 48, and by that I mean U.S. Code or Code of Federal Regulations. The federal government has the same playbook, whether you're in Alaska or whether you're in Texas or Puerto Rico.
Even though we feel special.
Even though we are special. We all know that. Let's all nod that Alaska's special. Yes, I'm seeing nods all the way around the room here. But despite that, there is only one playbook. And, you know, the U.S. Constitution and all of the supporting statutes and regs. What we learn of how the federal government responds or does not respond to the climate change issues that are occurring in rural Alaska can inform the federal government on how they can respond to the extreme weather events that are occurring right now in the lower 48 and that I believe will continue occurring for the next for decades to come.
Mm-hmm. You know, all it takes is one extreme event to get to the top of the list, right? Suddenly, you're the most important thing if people are out of home, you know. And so climate change in Alaska is kind of a slow process. We have some families that are looking at losing homes in some rural communities, but, you know, there's a clock ticking here, and it's likely to get worse. Everything you read suggests there's going to be more and more, and yet the federal government doesn't really seem focused on a kind of slow, methodical approach. It's disaster, you know, response more. So does that affect what you're able to do?
Well, let me respond on two levels to that. Yes, the government's very good at responding. I don't think the federal government is very good at proactively planning for the results of a extreme weather event. So that's what we're hoping to do is by looking at this and applying science that we can get there. The other thing is you didn't intend to mean this, but I want to attribute that, you know, you're much brighter than you think on this point. Uh-huh. And that is this, as you were talking about slow moving. That's one of the issues that we see going on in rural Alaska. We have slow moving disaster events that are not eligible for disaster declarations because they're slow moving. They're over months, they're over years. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we take a look what happened this summer, you had four either hurricanes or a tropical storm slam in the United States. Those are very discrete weather events that you can describe and measure.
Mm-hmm. Watch on TV even.
Right. And we don't have that at play here. And so permafrost degradation is slow and insidious, and it slowly decays. I mean, it slowly disrupts the built environment until the point it's no longer usable. But you don't measure that over the course of days or weeks. It's over years. Mm-hmm. And the federal government has not envisioned that at all, and we do not have authorities and appropriations to deal with those sort of threats.
Mm-hmm. Joel, if I could
butt in. Yes, jump in, Tom.
You know, you can actually measure erosion or shoreline change due in an individual event, in an actual storm. And so the concept of really slow motion change is not entirely correct, I believe. So, for example, in 2015, there was a big storm in Barrow. I'm sure you know about that. And the eroding force of that storm took out the berms that was holding
protecting
the water, protecting the community, really. Mm-hmm. And so once that berm was eroded, then the water just spread across the town, threatening the water supply. And all that happened in really just a few days. So
it can be quick.
So it really can be quick. Yeah. And you routinely you hear of a 30-foot erosion event during a given storm threatening, you know, infrastructure. So I actually used to have that point of view, and I do this stuff for a living. But when I've come to Alaska, the pace of change up here is really striking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I have one more question, but I mean, Tobias, thank you for jumping in because you guys know more about this topic than I do. But I want to ask about the communities that are getting prioritized this way. Do they have any input into it, or who makes – I know you have a whole, I guess you would say – a system of deciding what gets higher priority. Like you were saying in your introduction, you know, is this airport more threatened than, say, this health clinic in another location? But is there input from the community, or how do you grade these things? You have criteria that you're looking at, but is there, how does the community learn where they fall on the list? You know, how does that happen? Or is your audience mostly a Washington, D.C. audience that you're trying to, and funders that you're really trying to make sure they know we know where the needs are, I guess. So I'm just interested in that local piece versus this other audience in Washington, D.C. that might have wallets that we need to loosen. You know, that's two different things.
So we're talking about two classes of community. You're talking about communities that are facing relocation. Let me speak to that first. And then the second is communities that require a protect-in-place solutions. So with respect to the communities facing relocation, there are four that are prominent.
In the headlines.
There's Newtok, Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Shaktulik. Mm-hmm. Newtok is number one on our list of work. Now, we don't have implementing dollars. What we have is we have pre-construction dollars. So what we're doing is we're doing community planning, environmental assessments, geotechnical work, all the sort of work that needs to be done so that if and when cabinet-level agencies with the big checkbooks decide to step in, that work has been done, and we've shaved off a lot of development time. So that's been the approach the commission has taken. And Newtok was first because they'd already had the site, had already been conveyed to them by Congress. They'd already started work. In many respects, they are at the most threat because you can measure the erosion coming at them. Of the remaining three communities, Shishmaref recently voted for a new location. And this upcoming fiscal year, FY18, we're going to invest over $1 million to start the pre-construction activities in Shishmaref that we have been doing for the last 2 years in Newtok.
And for then relocation, right?
For relocation. Okay. And in Kivalina and Shaktulik, they have not yet selected a site. And so we're working with them and other partners, local, regional, statewide, and federal on, you know, on the relocation priorities the community has. And so we're engaging with them. In many respects, your question is, where is the community on this? This is where I acknowledge the state of Alaska is a decade ahead of the federal government. A lot of credit goes to former Governor Sarah Palin and her administration.
The sub-cabinet,
right.
Climate change.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They mm-hmm. started working on this. And then, you know, of course, Governor Walker, with his announcement yesterday, the Walker-Mulott administration is picking up where they last left off. So mm-hmm. the state's been a leader in this, and, you know, the federal government is just catching up. But the state has a very active engagement with each of these individual communities. They've got their individual planning groups, and they've been meeting and trying to make these choices that are appropriate for them. And so our funding that we're bringing in is already coming into that existing structure that the state had already built.
Mm-hmm.
So that responds to the question of those facing village relocation. In the case of Protect and Place Solutions, in many respects, we are waiting until the scientific analysis is completed, and then we can actually figure out, okay, when we grind the numbers and say, okay, this is what we think the threats are, that's when we really need to step forward and meet with the communities and say, we've done, you know, the science, we've done the analysis, and what we believe is that your threats are the airport or the clinic. Do you agree? And if not, why not? And so what we want the communities to truth test the academic studies mm-hmm. to be able to say, yes, that's our observation, or no, we don't think that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when the communities will step in.
And when will that happen? I think you have like a June 2018 deadline to finish this updated assessment.
You've done your homework, yes.
Well,
June 2018.
Thanks to your colleague who sent me some background. Yeah.
So that's when we're hopeful that the document will be available publicly. What I anticipate is that, you know, the next part, you know, the truth testing at the local level, that may take years. That's just not something that's done overnight. Mm-hmm. And that may take years with the 27 communities. And we haven't even talked about the remaining 200-plus rural Alaska communities.
Who may begin to experience more issues. I feel bad that I made you talk all that time and didn't even give these guys a chance to talk. So
be quiet.
No. I'm going to let our listeners know, if you're just joining us, our topic is big. It's climate change in Alaska. And we're talking about two initiatives that are ongoing right now to try to get arms around this issue, either on a community level or on a statewide level. So we were just hearing from Joel Niemeyer, who's the co-chair of the Denali Commission that is funding an update of a 2009 study to include permafrost degradation, which wasn't done in the original study, right? Or
and flooding.
And then we're going to turn now to Tom Ravens and Tobias Schwerer, who are co-PIs. What does PI mean? Private detective?
Investigator.
Principal investigator. And I think there's another PI, isn't there? No, it's just you two. Okay. And you have a different approach. You've been given some funding to, well, why don't we just let Tom describe it? You were going to give a little overview of what your project is like. But before you do that, let me just throw our numbers out for listeners in case they've got questions or they want to call in. 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. And again, it's climate change statewide. You know, we're certainly seeing a lot in the headlines for some communities, but there's probably going to be lots more. So, Tom, tell us about your project.
Thank you. So I want to thank Joel for sort of leading off and describing
being brave.
His, because it provides a good foil for our project. So, for example, while Joel's project is sort of like a screening study, looking at a whole bunch of communities and giving a really rough assessment of the risk that they face in these three areas, ours is going to be more focused on one or several communities. We're still working that out. But that's one difference is the focus. And the second difference is, I believe Joel's data is really what's happening right now. What can you observe right now? And what our project is going to do is anticipate the changes that are coming with a continued climate change, continued warming.
Do you do that with models? Is that how you do
Yes. So, in fact, what we're doing is really quite unique because we're basically going to be co-producing the coastal forecasting models with the communities themselves. So we have the beginnings of these models, but the models need to be calibrated and validated.
Truth tested.
Uh-huh. And so we'll be working with communities. Communities will be, putting out instruments, for example, and making measurements of erosion at high resolution, temporal and spatial, and also flooding. They're actually setting up cameras to sort of monitor storm mm-hmm. surge events. So with that data in hand, we'll be able to build better coastal
prediction.
Hazards mm-hmm. forecasting. Mm-hmm. Models.
So you might be able to say to a community, you're not having a problem now, but in 5 years, you're
going to... Well, that's exactly it. So what we have specialized at the university, at UAA, is anticipating the future effects of climate change, as well as the ones that have already happened, of course. So continued warming is going to basically continue to thaw permafrost, coastal permafrost. It's going to trigger subsidence, the lowering of the land surface. You're going to have sea level rise. The reduced sea ice is going to lead to larger waves. So all of these processes come together in very quantifiable ways, in fact. Mm-hmm. So we can actually simulate storm events 20, 40 years, 60 years into the future and say with some level of rigor, I think, exactly how much flooding that particular event is going to cause and how much erosion. And we'd like to do it this way because no one could say we're wrong.
Because you're forecasting. Now, something different about your project is your social scientists are coming together. And Tobias, you're looking like you want to jump in, so go ahead.
So this is a really exciting opportunity that we have
given funding by the National Science Foundation to do this. And what we really want to bring in is the community. And the community has not only local knowledge about their place, they also have boots on the ground. They can, like,
do measurements.
Like Tom said, they can be participating in climate change science. And that is really an area that we have not seen the participation from the community as much as I think we need in the future in order to tackle these problems.
Tell me why that's important. Why it's important for the community to participate.
I think it's hugely important because in the end, it comes down to making a decision. Mm-hmm. And so making that decision with the community is always more resilient, mm-hmm. more sustainable in the long term, mm-hmm. From a governance perspective too, not from an economic perspective, but something
they're deciding to do.
Right. Uh-huh. I mean, it's their choice in the end. Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. vote on it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, right now we have four communities. Very likely we're going to in the future have probably more than four communities. And so this project will really allow us to provide or to figure out a process where we can get the local community involved and also look at that ground truthing, not just from a geophysical and environmental perspective, looking at the coastline and how it recedes, but also from a social and economic perspective. Where are people's preferences about this? How do they would they make a choice mm-hmm. as a community, as an individual household? And so understanding that better. Mm-hmm. And using that in order to make decisions in the end is really valuable.
Yeah. Something I noticed between the two approaches, the update of the 2009 risk assessment looks at public property like airports and health clinics and schools. Something I noticed is you're looking at that, but you're also looking at cultural whether maybe there's a cemetery or meaningful cultural places or that, so I may be wrong that you're not doing that, Joel, in this one, but I definitely picked that up in reading your material. So speak to that. It's a little. Am I right that you're looking at public buildings Joel?
Largely public, but not just buildings. You're also talking about, utilities, airports, roads, that sort of thing. But the cultural resources, we're not looking
that's
at
That's not
that.
Exactly where you're at. No. So that's a differentiation between the two of you, yeah.
Right. So when you really have, those are really tough choices because the trade-offs are obvious because they may not be able to retain a culturally significant area, or they may. Maybe it's for the community very, very important, more important than retaining the school. Well, those are kind of questions that we will try to better. First, we need the community to really ask the questions in the proper way, mm-hmm. and then also try to understand where they're coming from and where they're. Better understand how they would make the choice.
Mm-hmm. You know, it does occur to me that one community will be the Cinderella, you know, that will get all this attention. But my question is for you, Tom, but scaling this up, do you see it as perhaps something that you do it in one place, but you learn from there and can take it to other places? Is that some of the thinking?
I believe so. So, for example, I think with Joel's study, they have a certain way of assessing risk. And, you know, it's probably like a common sense approach that is sort of generic. I think when we dive in and really grapple with the details of these coastal communities in Alaska, in particular Arctic Alaska, we might come to a different way of assessing risk than mm-hmm. what Joel's currently
maybe
doing.
Maybe a broader window as to what you will consider.
And
maybe taking the cue from the community more than.
Right. So I'm not sure how much economics are going to come into play with Joel's work. It seems that, because I think that probably is a little bit more details. But we are really going to be trying to assess the economic impacts of climate change, you know, of a particular infrastructure being sort of taken out or the cost of relocating a tank farm and that kind of thing so that. We'll have real
there's a price tag,
you know, this stuff is happening and there's a real cost associated mm-hmm. with it.
Yeah, Tobias, go
so it's really what we're doing right now. I mean, this is all a coastal zone management kind of question, and it's a risk management question. We're trying to go from the risk assessment that's currently underway that looks at relative risk scores of, and then prioritizing these communities. Mm-hmm. Once we have them prioritized, we can jump in and bring in the economics of basically adaptation economics. Mm-hmm. What are the best investments right now? What gives us the biggest bang for our investment mm-hmm. later on? It's really something that we want to answer, and we're looking at risk from a more narrow economic perspective, looking at probabilities of certain events happening, and then those events have certain damages associated with it. So on one hand, we need to understand the geophysical processes that are providing us estimates of probabilities of certain events happening, and then also looking at the potential damages and mm-hmm. understanding the damage function.
Mm-hmm. Well, with this idea that I know that you have, Joel, you have, the NALI Commission has funding allocated, I think you mentioned $11 million, but I wondered whether public buildings and facilities like airports and schools actually have more sway in getting dollars than, say, cultural treasures. Is that in the equation at all? Like, it's better or more helpful for you to point to public dollars that have already been spent putting this infrastructure in place versus a community has a strong feeling about, a place that they want to protect that isn't a public. It's important to them, but it is not a public facility that public money went into. Does that figure in your equation in your ability to get funding?
Well, I would argue that the way that Congress issues funding to the different agencies is largely formula-driven, competitive grant-driven, and so on and so forth. What that mainly means is the sophisticated communities, or those that are sophisticated enough to hire very good grant writers, are going to get the funds, whether it's a cultural asset or whether it's infrastructure or whatnot.
So that's not the test.
To me, it's
the grant.
To me, that is what the current issue.
Uh-huh.
What I would love to see is us moving towards the higher needs. And I do understand and appreciate a community may identify cultural assets as more important than, say, the airport. But you have to start somewhere. And so that as Tom, and I like the way you described it, the survey, that's what we're doing. We're doing a high-level survey, and then they're really diving deep in. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they're, in the end, I see these two efforts will come together in a complementary model that will then be able to identify what are the community priorities. And then they can communicate that upstream to funding agencies. And those funding agencies can then say, relative to other communities, okay, your airport, which you've prioritized, we'll get to it in 20 years. But, you know, the clinic, we can get to that next year. So that's the process by which I see happening. And mm-hmm. it is, I guess you can say I'm optimistic that the federal government will be responsive and change the way we do business so that once we can quantify the risk, they'll take that into account in the resource allocation models.
Okay, well, we need to take a tiny little break here. Again, we'll be right back. We're talking about climate change in Alaska and talking about two new initiatives to kind of wrap our state's arms around either a look at the whole state and the vulnerabilities of the whole state, but also another NSF-funded effort to look deep at a single community, which has not been selected yet, but to really engage the decision-making process at the ground level with economics and all kinds of information for that community. So we're going to come right back in about a minute, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and we are dealing with that unwieldy pillow of a topic that is climate change, but it has real circumstances and outcomes, and we're seeing it here in Alaska, certainly in some rural communities, but we expect scientists tell us that there's going to be many more communities feeling that. So how do we face it? And as you might recall from the first half hour, we talked about the Denali Commission's work to update a 2009 study that looked at erosion in rural communities, adding, you know, permafrost degradation and flooding to that. And it's going to take about a year to get that, right, Joel?
Yes.
And then we also talked about a NSF-funded grant with – we have the two principal investigators here sitting at the table looking very deeply at one community as it tries to come to grips with this decision. And that is Tom Ravens and Tobias Schwer. So, Tom – in the break, we talked a little bit about one other goal for your project that we haven't mentioned yet. Go ahead and jump in. It's something called a research network, but what is that?
So a research network is a group of researchers who are going to work together and identify gaps in knowledge and then basically pursue research opportunities to fill in those gaps. And one of the things that I think is special about our association is that he's a social scientist,
Tobias.
And I'm
Tobias.
An engineer.
Yeah.
Thank you. Tobias is a social. And, you know, normally we don't talk to each other. We like each other, but we're in different
You're
buildings.
You're friends, but you don't talk work.
We're
together.
In different silos, uh-huh. And so NSF has the wisdom to sort of force us together and work together, and so that's the really fruitful thing. Because prior to this, you know, the social scientists were doing one thing, and the engineers and physical scientists were doing something else. It wasn't a great integration. So NSF has achieved an integration here. And then moving forward, we're going to, on this research network, we're going to have social scientists, economists, physical scientists, engineers, all working together, identifying gaps, and then and finding ways to fill in those gaps.
So this network is going to include, you know, people in government agencies,
yes.
Other university, you know, UAF, or even yes. outside universities that are involved in work in Alaska.
Indeed. So the one thing about the Arctic and Arctic Alaska in particular is that it attracts people from around the world. So I'm involved in a number of projects in Arctic Alaska, and I'm working with people from University of Texas, from Texas A&M, University of Washington, University of New Hampshire. And so, but usually the way it works is we all have our individual separate projects, and we don't really talk to each other except, you know, on the side. But with this deep convergence effort, then we're really going to really make an effort. It's a point of the whole thing is to really work together with a wide array of researchers.
It's the idea that you might come out with an army of experts that actually know a lot or know who to call when they've got a question. And in other words, you're stronger for the group as opposed to, you know, the individual expert.
That's true. These natural systems and social systems are complex, and one person alone can't solve these
right.
problems.
Right.
So the intent that NSF really had with this was to initiate new research that fills important gaps, especially mm-hmm. in the multidisciplinary field.
But I mean, you know, Joel's here from yeah. the Denali Commission. They've got something going on. Are they part of your network? Mm-hmm. Will they be part of your?
No, I mean it goes beyond the academics in the group. I mean,
yeah.
the community is an important uh-huh. part, and other agencies that are working on the same issue.
Mm-hmm. In December, we had a show on the LEO network, an observation network around the state. They would be part of that as well.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what else? We wanted to talk about, I want to get to a little bit of the economics, because we talked a little bit about it yesterday, Tobias, about a community deciding, okay, if we stay here, it's going to cost this much. If we relocate, it's going to cost that much. You know, sort of giving them dollars and cents and price tags. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to adaptation economics, you need to think about the potential technology that you can harness in this case, to reduce your long-term risk of flooding, your long-term risk of losing infrastructure in your community. So it's about thinking about those investments, and those investments may be entirely given up and relocating, or following an in-place protection strategy, right? Mm-hmm. And that strategy really depends on the science, how much of the science is going to come along. The decisions we're going to make right now, they may be very different because the set of options we're going to have is now very different than in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, some communities, for example, in Switzerland, where they refrigerate their local glaciers in order to retain their tourism values, I mean, this is something I don't know. whether we could do this. But but we do have incredible renewable resources in Western Alaska where we have those permafrost issues. Like, it's cold in the winter. The air is very dense. We have a supreme wind resource sitting right there in the summer when the permafrost melts. We have 24/7
sunlight.
Mm-hmm. And we can use solar to perhaps refrigerate our permafrost. So these are all things that are going to come into this complex decision system that we need to figure out. And we need to have a framework in place that can capture all the available science that we got, all the perspectives and values that we got, and the options that are going to be laid out over time, including technological options and other options, and so to prioritize what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. So obviously,
where are we going to invest? I mean, it's all about investment.
Well, so it's such a moving target because, like, the science that we have today is not the science we're going to have in 10 years, is what you're saying. And so the solutions we might come up with today might not be good enough. We might have better solutions in the future.
But what I'm saying, we need a framework in place, an analytical framework that adapts over time and integrates new information coming in so that it makes better predictions of the future.
Right.
Because risk management is all about analyzing the options that we have right now to change a future outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we need a move from the risk assessment to a risk management, and that will be part of what we're going to try to do in ANCHOR, which is the acronym for our project.
Right. I don't remember what that means exactly.
That means Arctic Network for Coastal Community Hazard Observations and Integrated Research.
There you go. There's your network. Right. I was wondering whether you thought, and I know you're early on, this is just the first phase of what you're doing. I'm talking about the NSF-funded deep dive into one community, but the chance that this could scale for Alaska or even, the coast of California or the Gulf Coast where you're familiar. I mean, and it's maybe more the social science than our northern science may be different than the Gulf science, right? But the decision-making process might be very similar. What do you think, Tobias? In other words, could this process scale and go to other communities?
Oh yeah. I mean, this is nothing new. This is a process, or this is a framework that's been applied many times over and over. We just haven't applied it. And this is just another tool to make decisions. In the end, it will come down to a political decision, as always. But it's just a tool to highlight how to integrate the science that we got.
Right, and give context, I guess, to the decision making. So, well. Joel, what do you think about their project?
Well, I was aware of it, and I'm learning more, so I'm pleased by it. But again, when I talked about the idea of the survey, of the three various levels of risk, we'll have a reasonable understanding of that risk matrix at a statewide level, and we're going to have to drive down to the local level. Their model may be the best model, or we may find over time that their model, and they may be the ones who discover this, may be too big. And they have ways of narrowing it down so we can get to 200 communities.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you don't want to have a very exhaustive analysis on one community that's going to take us decades and decades to get through 200 communities. So one of the things that I would suggest that, this is what we did with our clinic program. What we did is we prioritized by grouping. So we had 14 groups of communities And so it's about 20 to 25 per community. So groups one and two were able to compete while everyone else had to wait. Several years later, then we opened up groups three and four, and then they were able to compete. And so there may be some sort of mechanism like that that we may bring in, because when you get down to the community level, it takes a lot of time. In the clinic example that I just talked about, what we found is the engagement with the community, once they got in through the door to start pre-construction activities, at a minimum, it was 18 months. Sometimes, you know, we had one community, the longest was 10 years. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time for the community to work through these questions about what's sustainable, what services they want, how does that translate to a facility. And that's just a clinic. Now you're talking about looking at this all across the community. It becomes much more complex.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how it'll look, but I'm pleased that they're doing their work. I'm pleased that we're doing our work, and I would expect sometime next year there'll be further discussion about what round two looks like in the idea of how best to assign resources to communities that are facing permafrost degradation, flooding, and erosion.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question for Joel.
Okay, Tom, go ahead and ask.
Because I've been thinking about it, like the risk associated with flooding is sort of different from the risk associated with erosion, for example. You know, if your building erodes into the sea or your tank farm, you know, it's essentially a total loss. Whereas with flooding, you know, you have lots of instances of communities that will just be flooded over and over again, and they keep on persisting even though they're getting flooded. And so how do you sort of quantify the different types of risks, the risk due to erosion and the risk due to flooding, given that kind of information?
Because they're different. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I don't know yet, to be honest. But what I would suspect would happen when you try to have a magnitude of risk. We know that erosion, once your land starts eroding, and whatever the asset is, you're pretty much talking about 100% failure. You're either going to have to rebuild or do major revetment work to protect it. So that's a huge investment. When it comes to flooding, it may be something as simple as what they did in Galena after the May 2013 flood. You may just jack up all the houses 4 feet. So I'm not exactly sure what that's going to look like, but I can tell you it's going to be different in every community, because there's going to be the erosion risks in some community may be minuscule and the flooding higher. I think the real challenge will come is when they're comparable. Then you're going to have a tough choice, which assets more at risk. And that's where the community dialogue comes in. If flooding and erosion are comparable, then you might say, okay, community, you help us decide.
Mm-hmm. I know, Tom, when you and I were talking yesterday, you mentioned different communities have geographic capital, you know, some have it, some don't. I think the example was Kivalina's in a very small, on a small island, sort of, whereas Unalakleet might be able to move, it has hills nearby. So that's another calculation, I guess.
Yes. And another thing from our conversation yesterday is that, you know, climate change has been happening in Alaska now for a couple of decades, and you already see communities responding to it in different ways. So as you say, in some cases, when a house is about to fall into the sea, they'll basically move it and put it up on the hillside if that's an option. And so mm-hmm. there's a sort of a natural sort of relocation of the community going on in some cases. In other communities, there really isn't a hillside. And so then what happens then? Then you have a real challenge, because mm-hmm. that's not really an option. Then the only possibility, it seems, is relocation. So I think each community is going to be looking at a different situation, which is why, Kathleen, you said we're going to be focusing on one community, maybe we're going to focus on one community, but maybe we're going to focus on a handful of communities, because I think it's interesting to sort of look at how climate change and coastal hazards is affecting different communities, mm-hmm. because they all are, all the communities are in a different place. different situation.
Yeah, like Joel said, it's an individual story in each location. But what were we going to jump in and say?
Yeah, from a social science perspective, there's also interesting questions. You know, which communities could actually have potentially better adaptation outcomes than other communities? And so the question would be from the question I would raise is, so can we understand the community structure, the social structure better in order to predict which outcomes they're more likely to face in the future? Mm-hmm. So that would allow us to then potentially intervene and then, start programs or work from the social end of things, mm-hmm. in order to bring adaptation outcomes, better adaptation outcomes for the future.
One scenario we did talk about yesterday was just the idea that coastal communities want to stay on the coast because they hunt marine mammals. This is the life they know. But we talked, broadly speaking, about other climate change issues like acidification in the ocean, the loss of sea ice, and therefore the loss of marine mammal availability to a community. And I guess this is part of, Tobias, part of this social science assessment, talking with people about where's your protein going to come from?
Right. I mean, these communities are really going to face really drastic trade-offs. I mean, mm-hmm. choices mm-hmm. they need to face. If there's no longer walrus available to hunt, then is the community potentially willing or not willing or able? Do they have the resources mm-hmm. in order to switch their subsistence lifestyle somewhat to a more land-based subsistence resource?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
those are the questions that are going to be very, very interesting, and we'll probably be grappling for a while with.
Yeah. Another thing I read recently, just getting ready for this, was it was a PRI, public radio story about the city of Anchorage not really having the funding to help rural Alaska. If many rural Alaska communities decide to relocate to Anchorage, it doesn't have the resources here. You know, so it gets us back to the money question. And I guess, you know, Joel, you've said you're optimistic. And I think from Tobias, I really have picked up this sense that Alaskans figure it out. You know, locally, we'll figure it out. We're pretty creative. Did you talk already about the YK Delta wind warming in winter? Just it's not your project, it's somebody else's. But the creativity behind some of the solutions Alaskans come up with. And so I really didn't want to have a show where people go away saying, oh, I still don't understand climate change and I really don't understand what's going to happen. I wanted to leave them with some sense that we have direction, we will prevail, whether it's federal money that comes through or state money that comes through or even, you know, elbow grease on the ground here in Alaska. So
yeah, I think Alaskans have been resilient for thousands of years, mm-hmm. and we're still here.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
They're still here. I mean, I'm kind of an outsider coming in, right?
Yeah.
And so, but what I've observed during my last, 18 years in the state is that Alaskans are really innovative and they're smart about how to adapt to change.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that all across Western Alaska, where there is renewable energy being harnessed, especially mm-hmm. wind energy. And mm-hmm. so there's a few communities in the Kuskokwim Delta who figured out how to heat with wind. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, 10 years ago, we would have thought, oh,
right.
These guys are crazy. But they are doing it. And they tremendously reduced their dependence on fossil fuels. And what happens is that the local dollars that they 15 years ago spent on fossil fuels and that leaked out of the community, well, that local dollar stays in the community. So it
yeah.
is part of, it can be part of economic development for the community. So this also really shows that we need to think about and integrate local communities into this process. And I think we'll all be better off because
they might have
a
good idea.
Yes.
yeah.
And they know their land better than we do.
Yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I would like to leave everyone with optimism, but I think instead I'm going to give.
But you can't.
I'll leave everyone with controversy because, you know, just think of the situation in Alaska. So I believe the state of Alaska has $50 billion in the bank, essentially, which is largely derived from fossil fuel production. That combustion of all those fossil fuels is essentially what has caused the climate change problem. And so within the same state, in some cases, in amazing proximity to one another, you have some communities that have gotten super, super wealthy from pumping oil out of the ground. And then you have other communities that, you know, essentially have to move because of the changes that ensued associated with. And the wonderful thing about Alaska is a lot of that wealth is still around. It's in the permanent fund. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from a kind of like just a pure ethical point of view, shouldn't these people who have to move from their homes because of climate change, shouldn't some of their costs be borne by the wealth that was associated with creating those coastal hazards?
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's kind of a balancing act, I guess. Yeah. Okay, so we are just down to a couple of minutes, and sometimes I'll go around and I'll say, what do you want people to leave people with to think about? So I didn't warn you in advance, Joel, but I'm going to go to you.
You're starting with me first again?
Okay, well, we'll choose someone else if that's too much pressure. just a sentence or two, so, you know, what should people walk away with thinking about this?
Well, in this particular case, I would say that former President Obama came and pointed a light at climate change when he came up to Alaska, and he signed us as lead coordinating agency. Unfortunately, that didn't equate to any cash. I had identified that the Denali Commission has put almost $11 million to this question of village relocation and protect and place solutions. And I want to give full credit to that to my six commissioners, who are all Alaskans. They're not federal employees. They are, you know, high-level leaders. And I think they deserve some credit for saying, we need to work with the local communities, the regional players, and our state and federal agencies in finding solutions. So those six commissioners really deserve accolades for this.
Their feet on the ground here in Alaska, right?
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And how about from the NSF side of things? You want to start, Tobias? What do you want people to think about?
Oh yeah, I just want to leave it with our listeners. I think it's the ball is in their court too. They can call up their legislators and talk about this issue with them. And I think the state needs to step up the game here, not just by waving the ads that they start a new commission or whatever who's dealing with this, but putting some resources behind it so we can start tackling these problems. And the sooner we're really figuring out how to tackle it, the better we'll be, because the risk is only going to get greater.
Mm-hmm. We'll start refrigerating our glaciers and our permafrost. How about you, Tom?
So two things. First, I think no one said anything about greenhouse gas emissions, but and people might not know that really there's a lot that we can do even now about changing our future. If we aggressively move to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, it'll make a huge difference. It's going to mean life or death for millions of people, guaranteed. Second thing is we can totally shift to renewable energy. The technology is there. It's just a question of special interests who are running essentially the government have decided not to allow that to happen. And then the third thing is, with those renewable energy, we can really solve some of these problems by, for example, refrigerating the coast and protecting high-value assets.
Things
Thank you.
Things we have not ever imagined before. Well, you hear the music, which means we're just about to be out of time. So I want to thank my guests, Joel Niemeyer from the Denali Commission, Tobias Schwerer, and Tom Ravens. Tobias is from ICER, and Tom is from UAA's College of Engineering. They're working together on an NSF grant to work on climate change. And of course, our listeners we had one caller that we didn't get to today. I'm sorry, but we appreciate our listeners. And I'd like to let you know Charles Walforth will be your host next week. He's going to be talking with grandparents who are raising their grandchildren thanks to the opioid epidemic. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.